Hello and welcome to SF3, also known as Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.
Podcast where we review audiobooks and then come back for a thorough discussion after giving you a break and time to escape if you don't want to hear about spoilers in the book. How's everybody doing today?
Rusty.
Rusting.
Great.
Okay. Well, what are we reviewing today, Stephen? Well, we are reviewing The Stone Sky by N.K. Jemisin, narrated by Robin Miles.
And it's up for a Hugo.
It's up for a Hugo. I think this is our final Hugo nominee for this year.
Indeed.
It better be. Nothing against the book.
We're running out of time.
All right. From the back of the book, this is the way the world ends. For the last time. The moon will soon return. Whether this heralds the destruction of humankind or something worse will depend on two women. Essun has inherited the power of Alabaster Tenring. With it, she hopes to find her daughter, Nasun, and forge a world in which every Orogene child can grow up safe. For Nasun, her mother's master of the Obelisk Gate comes too late. She has seen the evil of the world and accepted what her mother will not admit, that sometimes what is corrupt cannot be cleansed, only destroyed. And if you haven't read the previous two books, that was pretty much gibberish. All right. What did everybody think? Kevin?
I thought it was pretty good.
In depth. Barry?
I really liked it. I think this is my favorite of the three books. You finally get to see the moon, or the donut, as I like to call it. Donuts.
Yes. There should be a version of this with Homer Simpson.
I think I liked it because we finally get to, like, you know, like the end of, you know, and finally get to see the
not praising with faint damnation again.
That's not what I meant, but you know, we've been reading, you know,
we achieved the climax.
Yeah, I was trying to avoid using that word, but thanks. Yes, the boil bugs have come forth, and
that was in the last book, but yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Kevin, again, any more to say?
Yeah, actually, I think just this whole setting is really vivid. You know, there's a lot of kind of cool, like the giant obelisks that, you know, store up huge amounts of magic and stuff like that. You know, the kind of the two kind of partnering.
If you like giant floating rocks, this is the series for
it
you.
It is.
Asteroids?
If that's just your thing, is just you want to have rocks that are floating just over the earth, then.
Well, and, you know, there's like kind of like the two, not really competing, but two different magic systems that end up kind of to be related, you know, kind of like the
orogeny and magic.
Yeah, there's the earth magic, you know, where they get energy out of the earth in different ways. And then, you know, the silver or whatever they called it, or one of the characters called it the silver, right? Or it's like, mm-hmm. you know, the magic, like sort of, if you zoom in a bit more and into, you know, subatomic particle land or something, basically
enhance.
It's like,
enhance.
Yes, it's like, oh, there's the magic right there in between all the, you know, atoms and everything.
Yes. Though managed to avoid the midichlorian trap by still not exactly explaining what the magic was and also just not sucking.
Right. Right. And then the whole thing with the earth elementals, you know, / stone eaters where, you know, it's like, this was the first book where I kind of thought, oh, I can kind of viscerally grasp how, you know, an earth elemental could just sort of like move through earth without kind of getting stuck or like drilling. It just kind of like floats through the earth, just like it's walking through air kind of, but, mm-hmm. but you know, more like passing through the molecules.
Right. Yeah. I liked it a lot too. You get a lot of backstory and there's a lot of sort of cool technology that's left over from the previous civilization. And I don't know, it's kind of a theme park ride, but in a good way. You know, it's like, so there's a lot of big set pieces and a lot of exciting things happening. And I thought it brought the series to a very solid close.
Yeah, it was a satisfying ending, which seems to be difficult to do. So
yeah, it sticks to landing.
It's nice that, you know, ended that way because I like the first two books also, so.
Exactly. Well, I think it's time for us to borrow a stone eater and jump through the center of the earth to our discussion section. We will return, for we are SF3, also known as Sci-Fi.
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 And welcome back to our review of The Stone Sky by N.K. Jemisin. So this book actually sort of is heavily based around the Gaia hypothesis. I mean, in this book, the Earth itself is alive and actually has intentions. And actually, it turns out that a lot of what's been going on is an undeclared war between humans and the Earth itself. What did people think of this idea?
I thought it was interesting. At first, it was kind of jarring because I'd assumed that all of the seasons were because the moon was on some wacky, you know, elliptical orbit.
Right.
And that it, whenever it kind of came back into range, it messed everything up. But in this book, it's basically like, oh no, the Earth is just like causing crazy earthquakes every once in a while. And
yeah, I thought that was kind of cool. You know, it's like, oh, I'll release chlorine gas and see if I can, you know, kill you all with this. I thought of like some sort of like mad scientist experiment.
Yeah, at first it was a little bit like, you know, the fact that it has a single consciousness was a little bit jarring at first.
Sure.
As opposed to just like, oh, it's alive, you know.
But it's got sort of a collective consciousness or something
or
that
just,
acts like a consciousness.
Or just isn't really conscious per se. It just kind of, you know, it's the vampire whatever.
Lestat.
Oh, God. You can remind like me what
French
the term that
statistics.
We use, which now that I'm totally blanking on it.
I don't
space
know.
Space vampire.
Or space whatever. Vampire, yes. That's the French term we use.
God, this makes lots of sense now.
Okay, we're just going to move on. Yeah. I mean, so I will call out something that's more a problem with me than the novel. Whenever we read something that is in the fantasy realm, but not full on, you know, high fantasy, I have a tendency to want it to be science fiction in disguise. And so I really wanted the origins and all of this to just be some kind of science-based thing.
And it is geomancy.
Geomancy. And yeah, the Earth being alive is, of course, just, you know, that's just a thing.
Because when there's lots of magic, you're now conscious.
I mean, you know,
it explained it. It's totally science.
Yes, they just said magic.
But did it meet Kevin's, you know, one requirement that all that the magic system be consistent?
Well, actually, I mean, it was relatively consistent.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, question answered.
It was mostly rhetorical.
Too late.
I know. I've done the bad thing again.
So, yes, at the end, we discover that this is being told to the Stone Eater version of Esnon, her backup copy, as it were. Did that add to the story as a narrative framing device?
Well, I think it was kind of confusing. You forgot the framing most of the time. And because sure. I think all three books did this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had the mixed framing for different chapters.
Right.
And so you're sort of like, well, you know, every once in a while when it comes back in, you're like, oh, that's right. This story is being told to somebody, but I don't know who. And so they finally do explain, yes, it's, you know, it's Esun after she basically becomes a stone eater at some indeterminate point in the future.
Right.
I mean, which makes it gestation.
A fairly rare example of a second person novel, but not so much as anyone would notice because, right. You know, it's being told to this person, but Esun is still referred to, I think, as just, you know, Esun, not, and then you did that, which would have been really annoying.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, yeah, it's kind of a long, you know, payoff, right? You got to get through all three books to find out this at the end, which is, you know, sort of like a, almost like a meta plot reveal,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was, it was a neat construct in the book.
Right. So I guess, do we have guesses as to how this timeline relates to our own? Do we think that this is just a completely different world, or is this in the past or in the future?
Right. I doubt it's in the past, but it did occur to me that it could be in the future, you know, probably relatively far future when they have that tech, you know, where they can, you know, hey, look, we can, you know, take energy from the Earth and we don't have to, you know, do whatever else we're doing. But yeah, I don't know that that's actually explained one way or another for sure, but it seems possible.
I mean, I think it's certainly in the future, but it's kind of got that feel of having just finished rewatching Battlestar Galactica, right? You know, sort of like time is a big circle and
Barry's been on a cultural kick recently. He's been watching Battlestar Galactica and that unsung literary masterpiece, Chips.
Paunch and John are awesome.
Not saying they're not. But what if they had Earth Jedi powers?
Well, they'd be even more awesome. I mean, is Sergeant Gatrer like an, you know, a stone eater?
In disguise.
Moving on, and expressing regret for having opened this particular Pandora's box.
I have many regrets. This is not one of them.
Yes.
No, but I think, you know, going back to the original question, right, it's, you know, there's an element there of where there's like one big supercontinent, right, which kind of makes it feel like it's in the past. But there's all this, you know, technology now in the book that makes it feel like the future. So to me, it's, you know, it's hard to figure out, you know, what exactly is going on there. Because I'm pretty sure like the continents wouldn't like just drift back together.
I think they have at some point. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, Pangaea, they were. Right?
Yeah, they were. And
then they drifted apart.
Then they drifted apart. But I think that I have heard some, you know, I vaguely remember hearing some theories that that might happen again.
I'm not saying it's aliens, but.
You know, but I do need to visit my hairdresser. Yes.
I think I missed the whole Pangaea thing or whatever. I don't remember that being mentioned, but I guess it was.
Well, okay. One thing that I was having trouble tracking was they talk about Antarctica Station, but they don't mention it being cold. Was it just a massive climate change?
Yeah, it was a pretty massive climate change.
Okay.
Everything was kind of.
But I mean, that's just madness. That would never happen.
You're right. That is all fake.
That's just a natural cycle of the Earth when it's trying to kill the people trying to destroy it.
Well, I mean, that does make sense.
Well, it was kind of funny, too, because, you know, Nasun, you know, goes to, was it Core Point or whatever? Or one, either that or one of the other cities where there was a lot of geomancy and it was kind of like, you know, future tech. And it was kind of like one of those things where they had like a magic healing bed and stuff like that, but it was all run from magic. And she was like, why would someone bother to essentially make something that was programmed with magic or something? And, you know, it's like, you know, you could do this with your mind and do this, you know, heat something up or whatever it is, or heal something. But why would you somehow make, you know, this mechanical construct that could do the same thing? So it was kind of like this, you know, like they say, it's like magic tech.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, geopunk or whatever, but it's just like this, you know, she was kind of saying like, this just seems so bizarre that it's kind of like a Wall-E kind of thing, right? Where everybody is like just totally dependent on this, you know, very wide availability of magic and they just kind of sit there and, you know, sit in luxury all the time. And so that's why they're sort of trying to make it even more, and you know, this, it's not enough because, you know, we can't do absolutely everything we want. Like,
right. They had made like ornamental gardens or something like that. They just had, you know, all kinds of magic everywhere in these cities that,
right,
you know, just because it was pretty at some points.
Right. I mean, it's like kind of like, you know, like the Greek gods or something, and they have, you know, some amazing, you know, like you said, gardens and things like that. And all the stuff is like really nice to live there, but it's kind of built on top of, essentially, there's, you know, they talk about the, you know, because there's a lot of flashbacks where they talk about the early life of the Stone Eaters.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, before they were these sort of like magical living statues, earth elemental things.
Right.
They were basically just genetic, you know, genetically constructed, you know, humans that had like really powerful magic abilities.
And I kept on trying to make them AIs was my problem.
Well, that's what you do with everything.
Yes, that is also my problem.
I am an AI, maybe, or not. I don't know.
Well, artificial.
Yes. Well, I guess you can go the other ways too, where it's like artificially unintelligent or naturally unintelligent. Like, you know,
we call those people.
Yes.
I am meat.
But early on, you know, that's kind of like, you know, they're going through how, oh, they've made these, you know, these people that have this, you know, really strong magical ability, and they're basically, you know, all living in a lab, and they're like, oh, you know, good dog, now you're going to like, we're going to do this great human accomplishment and you're the one doing it and it's going to be great. And aren't you so proud that you're doing this to help everybody? And
by the way, we're going to kill you afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, well,
it's never stated.
All the people that are in the program that didn't quite work out or were too, you know, mouthy or rebellious or whatever, they don't go through all the details, but they basically say if somehow you didn't work out,
you're sent to Urine Town, you're sent into the cornfield.
Well, basically, yeah, you're sent to the, I forget what they called it, the briar patch,
right?
Where it's like, you know, the you basically you're this living magical battery that, you know, you're kind of like half quasi conscious, but you're going to live essentially forever in this kind of like not very fun, painful state, I think it was.
That was actually a great scene where their human handler, or actually sort of the first origin, I guess, is taking them out on a walkabout to see the outside world.
Right.
And this was all just a cover to show them essentially the briar patch.
Right.
And, you know, she gets called back in, so the administrator comes in and finishes off the tour and
right.
doesn't even, you know, register the fact that, oh, he's taking them to see the dead versions of their kind.
Right. I mean, it's just like this horrifying thing in the context of the situation where he's just like, oh, here, let me give you a tour of these showers or whatever. It's really great. And they're just like, are you kidding me? This is horrible. And he's like, well, you know, we don't really use these anymore. And it's just like,
we don't need to.
Yeah, you know, and now we have you, like, you know, self-regulating and not really causing trouble and stuff.
You're properly subjugated now.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so it's like, I mean, it's a major subtext of what's going on, but it's not like you're not hammered on the head with it, I mm-hmm. think. I think you could easily kind of miss this part of the book if you're not really, if you know.
If you're not good readers like us.
Well, I don't know. I won't say that, but, you know, I think it would be easy to read the book, you know, for pleasure and not notice some of the subtext, I think.
But, exactly.
And then reread it later, you know, and then kind of go, oh, wow, yeah, there is this kind of like horrifying, like, you know, the slave race essentially that they construct just so they can have an even more awesome time all the time. Like,
yeah. Oh, and apparently, I mean, had we heard about the Nies before?
I don't think so.
So, yeah, the Stone Eaters were this artificially constructed race, and then they were actually kind of built a little bit in the image of the Nies, who were this group that had gotten wiped out, and they were supposed to have these, you know, mysterious powers. And I get the impression
by wiped out, I believe the term was genocide.
Yeah, exactly. No, they weren't just really tired.
Yeah.
But they, there had been all of these rumors about them having these amazing powers, and it turned out they pretty much didn't, but you know, they,
right. But it was easier to help demonize them and
right. What else? Oh, yes. And destroying the Earth. So it's
this is where I go, yay.
I was under the impression that, you know, Nasun was going to be this, you know, bent on destruction, diabolical genius type of character. And it turned out that all of her friends wanted her to destroy the Earth as well.
Uh-huh. Do it.
Well, her Shafa was basically kind of like, at that point, he's like, whatever you want to do, you know, I'll support you.
Right. Unconditional love can definitely go in strange directions.
Right. And the Stone Eater, which I don't remember the name that they used, but it was like
silver or something.
Like, yeah, no, there was
gray or metal
or something. I don't remember.
Well, they're metal names.
They basically, that one was like, I've lived long enough and I don't want to live anymore because I can't die because I'm a Stone Eater. Right.
So the only way I can die is by,
you know, just destroy the whole earth.
And
the joke's on you. It'll just end up floating through space for eternity.
Then it turns out that Shafa is dying and her only way of saving him is to turn absolutely everybody in the world into Stone Eaters. And so she's trying to do that. And fortunately, she is intercepted in that by her mother, Esun, who basically gets things back in. You know, it turns out that all of this is really just sort of a negotiating point in a big discussion with the Earth itself.
Just for the record, I was also very turning everybody into a Stone Eater. Very pro.
Surprise. Well, it was interesting, too, because Nasun wants to just destroy the Earth. Esun is like, okay, we can bring the moon back as it's, like, you know, coming close. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can fix everything, which in the last book, you kind of thought, oh, that'll just fix everything. Because like I was saying, I thought that the seasons were because of the moon orbit. Now we find out it's actually the Earth saying, screw you, you know, humans, for destroying everything. And, you know, stepping over, you know, bounds, you know, way too, like, one too many times.
Right.
And so, you know, she is going to do that, but then Nasun's already there, already controlling stuff, and she's going to destroy the other. So she's like, oh, I have to battle my daughter. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of have their you know, psionic battle.
It was somewhat of an atypical battle because Nasun brings that wall up. And, you know, Esun is just like, I don't know how she's doing this. This is creepy. She's combining magic and orogeny.
Oh, right.
I didn't teach her to do this.
And I didn't even know you could do this. And the Stoner is like, oh, yeah, those are just called tuners, or that's what we called them, or
right,
something.
Which was the original name of the Stone Eaters, right?
Well, that's just kind of like a functional name I think they had. But it was, yeah, and that, which is a very common trope in a sense that it's like, oh, look, you can, if you work together, it's, you know, more than the sum of the parts, that kind of thing, which
except
is true.
It's sort of the nominal villain that's doing this.
Right. But I thought actually the resolution was interesting and, you know, where the daughter's pushing and they're basically like, okay, you know, this is going to be something bad happening. It kind of depends on who wins the upper hand, you know, next round or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the mother is just like, I'm not going to kill my child. I only have one child left. You know, all my other ones are dead. You know, I can't see another of my, so I will sacrifice, you know, the earth so that my child, you know, cannot die or at least have the chance of not dying.
Right. And she just turns herself into a statue.
She just stops.
Yes.
And at that point, you know, Nasun is sort of like, oh crap, you know, and then, you know, everything has already kind of been, you know, like as they kind of say in the book, it's kind of like the obelisk has been programmed with, you know, okay, save the moon. Should I execute?
Right. It's just, it's got a blinking cursor with yes, no.
Yeah. Hit return. Like, you know,
and it's probably, you know, just us thinking about this in Apple II terms again.
I know. It's like a little terminal blinking green screen.
our apocalypse tech.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the worst part is like the, you know, the upper 2/3 of the monitor have burned out and you can't actually see the question. It's just yes or no. You're like, yeah, sure. Why not?
Yes.
I don't know what it is. Just hit return. So, I mean, that seems actually, you know, I could see that being like, you know, a parental response of like, okay, you know, I'll save my kid, you know, even if it's going to like destroy the earth. That sounds, you know, like a good, you know, potentially
win,
not
win.
Yeah.
That's my line.
So, you know, it was an interesting resolution as opposed to like, whoever can hit harder wins, you know, that kind of thing. Like,
yes. No, I thought that was a great scene as well. Speaking of which, favorite scenes. So I think my favorite scene was when they decided to take a train through the center of the earth.
Choo choo.
I mean, it would have. Okay, it wasn't actually a train, but it was more or less.
It was an underground.
It's Elon Musk's dream, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Except that the earth is alive and is really pissed off and is showing nasty faces.
That was a Doctor episode also.
Of course it was.
Although I thought that was kind of silly in that episode, a face the size of the entire planet, but whatever.
At least it wasn't the face of Bo.
Yes.
Probably they have better production values inside your mind, you know.
Probably. This looks really good when I'm writing on paper. It looks kind of weird when
it's just like then you superimpose a rubber mask or just like, you know, the face of somebody who happened to be walking by the studio at the time.
They should have just superimposed that old like Man in the Moon thing with the rocket in the eye.
The old H.G. Wells Meliers thing. Yeah.
Oh, that would have at least been amusing.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, I like that. And especially the fact that they sort of upped the dramatic stakes by having Shafa going nuts in the middle there.
Yeah, no, I kind of thought that was interesting. Also, that the fact that later on you realize, oh, the Guardians are actually being controlled by the Earth. Mm-hmm. That, you know, because you kind of think there's some, you know, something behind them maybe, but you don't quite know what. And then they basically say, oh, no, they're just sort of like Earth puppets.
Which is, of course, the name of our rock, punk band that sings entirely songs about N.K. Jemisin novels.
Earth puppets. Yes. No, I think my favorite, you know, scene classification, we'll say, are the crystal people. So basically, when, you know, just for the imagery, where Nasun is, you know, does something and basically, you know, in order to stop, you know, something bad happens, she basically turns these people into like gem statues.
Yes.
And that also kind of overlaps with, I think, you know, originally I think my favorite was the description of when Esun, you know, basically breaks out of her cocoon geode.
Right. And By the way, gem statues also opens for earth puppets.
Gem statues. Yes.
I thought that was the backup band.
That too, yes. We are Earth Puppet and the Gem Statues.
Gem Statues just as like Earth Puppet cover.
Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
But just, I think it's just the imagery of like this statue made completely out of these, like, you know, what we would consider to be, you know, very valuable gemstones. But also just, I think, the bigger image of when Esun is sort of been cocooned inside of a geode, that the Stone Eater sort of is like, okay, I take all of the parts that, you know, as you were casting magic, essentially you parts of your body turned into stone. You know, we take all those, and after you're, you know, after you're done, you know, we kind of mix it all up, put it in a geode or construct a geode somehow, and you incubate for some millennia until you, you know, pop out as a Stone Eater, which it was kind of the, what I got out of how it worked.
Okay. I think you figured it out better than I did.
And, but just like the image of like being in this like geode cocoon was, seemed awesome.
Geode cocoon, of course.
Another, at least
another band.
That's the opening band.
That's the opening band. Yeah.
So I think my favorite scene was, I don't know if it was like one scene in specifically, but the whole point where, you know, Esun's arm turns to stone, right? And, you know, at some point she lets, I think it's Hoa that,
yeah,
that mm-hmm. basically chomps or, you know, nibbles it off or something like that. And, I don't know. For some reason, I just went back to that and listened to it a few times. It's
well, I think we found your fetish then.
AMSR Stone Eater.
Well, I mean, even just, you know, the fact that
ringtone.
You know, she was pointing out that, you know, unlike who was the other the other person who was turning a stone, and that was Alabaster, right?
Alabaster, right?
And so when he had the same thing done to him, it was sort of like gnawed off and left like all sharp and jagged. But,
right.
You know, when Hoa did this for Esun, it was, you know, very neatly done. And he'd kind of like, you know, polished the end into like a nice, you know, like eraser nub.
Right. Yeah, that whole like Alabaster, that reveal that it's like, oh no, Alabaster's not dead. He's just a Stone Eater now.
Yeah.
Mm. And they kind of, I thought that was like, oh, well, that was a twist I wasn't expecting. And they also kind of cleanly, you know, explained why, well, why can't he come back and just save the day, right? He's super powerful now. It's like, oh, well, you know, basically it's like it would be wrong because he's still sort of, you know, forming his mind or whatever, and you would right. just sort of mess with it.
Well, let's see. Yeah, there was also the scene where she has to choose another body part to turn to stone.
Right.
So she's just like, I'll choose my right breast because it was my left arm. So I want to kind of keep it balanced.
Right.
And I always liked the other breast better anyway.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting choice. It made me sit there and think, I'm like, well, if I had to, you know, pull the big power move, like what body part would I be willing to give up?
Dunno. I'd have to think about that.
I guess it is a weight loss plan.
I mean, yes. If it's sheer mass, I can yes. I can give some up.
So that means that, you know, people training to be Origins, if they're min-maxing their character, it's like, you know, okay, first make them like a sumo wrestler that yeah. becomes an Origin or something like that.
Yeah, it seemed like it was somehow correspondent to quote unquote a body part. So you couldn't just say, oh, okay, it shall
my
be
outer layer of fat.
Shaved as 20 fat.
Yeah, the 20 pounds of around my my muffin top, so to speak.
Like, yep. Yeah. Well, we went there, I guess. All right.
My muffin top organ. Yes.
Okay. Barry, did we do a favorite scene from you? Yes, we did.
Yes, we did.
Okay, great. All right, so the usual questions. Was there tea? Yes, but not as you know it. Well, I mean,
we don't know. Make it superior tea?
They did actually, they did explicitly say, you know, there was a line where she came down to the party in the morning and everyone's complaining that someone drank the tea already or something. So they didn't explain what the tea was, but apparently there's something called tea.
All right, and I still liked the drink called Safe, where I think it was you mixed it with water, and if the water was safe to drink, then it changed a particular color.
Yeah, I think that's a callback to the first book.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that kind of, I totally missed, or at least I remembered as being sort of the traditional thing that you drank when you were talking with somebody to prove that you weren't giving them like a poison or yeah. something like that. Like
it's kind of both, right?
Okay. Let's see. Then what character would you want to be, and or who would you be, or which group would you belong to, et cetera, et cetera. I think we've figured out Barry.
I want to be the Earth.
Well, yes.
Good I would job. Definitely cook you all.
I would want to be a Stone Eater.
Yeah, Stone Eater sounds cool. Either a Stone Eater or one of them, one of the magic users.
I mean, I'm still disappointed that they're not artificial intelligences, but we can't have everything.
Well, you can't have everything.
You could pretend.
Well, I mean, Kevin can have actually, everything. He just doesn't know where to put it.
The closest to that would be like, you know, maybe I could be one, you know, what is it? The which obelisk was the main one that's hanging around?
The onyx one,
yeah.
So that's definitely like left open for a future book. It's like, oh, let's hope that no origin finds this buried in the ocean. Nudge, nudge. Like, you know.
Also, Onyx Obelisk is the name of the first album of Earth Puppets.
Well, because they've said that, you know, basically if you pump enough magic into something, it becomes conscious.
The Onyx Obelisk and the Geotones.
Okay. All right. Anything else we want to go?
And the origins, I think it would be.
Yes, exactly. All right. Well, I think it's time for us to draw down the moon and see if we can make some minor improvements around here.
But when the moon's in a certain position, you could look through the hole and see stars on the other side.
I'm just hoping it's secretly a pastry.
My God, it's full of stars.
Pastries don't have holes usually, do they? Donuts do.
Well, a donut is a pastry.
My God, it's full of sprinkles.
Okay. Yes. Well, this has been an advertisement for our new podcast, Is a Donut a Pastry?
Or Are All Pastries Donuts?
Something
or
like that.
Or All Donuts Pastries?
It's a work in progress.
Yes.
Anyway, yes.
Toroidally, stay tuned for Chipla.
Yes. if you would like to reach us for any reason.
Or starve for attention.
You can reach us on Twitter at SF3Podcast, by mail at sf3podcast@gmail.com, and on Apple Podcasts at sci-fi or SF3. And if you're from New Zealand or are currently in New Zealand, we can see you downloading. So drop us a line.
I'm going to find some random country and set up a VPN and see if I can get myself mentioned.
The country that we are in is a very random country, so you have achieved this goal.
Iceland?
Yes, sure. Okay, then until next time, we have been Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.